It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll take a look at why gas prices keep falling and how low they might go.
First, chances are, if you live in Wisconsin, you've clocked some happy time in the summer along Lakes Michigan or Superior, but the Great Lakes in wintertime can be a tougher sell.
But our next guest says if you skip the Great Lakes in the winter months, you're missing out. She's here to tell us about recent ice volcanoes on Lake Michigan and other ice features to look for when you're exploring the Great Lakes in wintertime.
Carolyn Rock joins us now. She's a natural resource educator at Whitefish Dunes State Park in Door County. She's the 2014 recipient of the Wisconsin State Historical Society's Preservationist of the Year Award. Carolyn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, most of us associate summertime with the Great Lakes. Now, you work along the shores of Lake Michigan in Door County. Why is it worth our time to check out Lake Michigan in the winter?
There's always changing. It's always unique. You can have the ice build up. Although right now we have no ice build up on the Great Lake. I'm looking out over Lake Michigan at Whitefish Bay right now, and we have a little bit of ice formation along the shorelines, but it's melting fast. But you never know from week to week. From month to month, the ice builds up, the ice creates different formations, and it disappears, and it's always ever-changing. And that's part of the uniqueness of coming to the shoreline in wintertime.
And I suppose the climate we're having this week kind of puts you in this awkward in-between phase. It's not warm enough to enjoy the summer activities. It's not cold enough to see some of those ice formations that we're so excited to talk about today.
Yeah. It is, and we're hoping for a little bit of snow coming through and maybe some colder temperatures to make those formations happen.
Mm-hmm. So the ice volcanoes just made news last week, though, before the meltdown a bit. What can you tell us about what they are?
Well, they're quite unique in the sense that...
Carolyn, are you there? Oh, I think we have lost Carolyn.
I think I'll have to try her back. And I know Carolyn is going to talk about...
She's really a master of the hook, leaving us with a cliffhanger.
She has some wonderful stuff to talk about. She sent us some beautiful pictures that will be up on the Central Time Facebook page a little later, and some ice circles, which are posted there right now. Now, have you ever heard of ice circles, Cynthia?
No, I haven't.
I hadn't either. So there's these little sort of bobbing circles of ice on the water, almost like you could leapfrog among them.
Okay. I had pictured the opposite, more like ice holes. You know, I was picturing something that would have broken out of the sheets of ice rather than something that's floating. But we will also have a video of some of these things as well. And you might have seen them floating around Facebook from the Wisconsin DNR, putting out videos from the ice volcanoes that had erupted, so to speak, last week. If you might have seen any, give us a call. Let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you like to get out on the Great Lakes in the wintertime? And if so, what do you do? What are some of the things that you be sure to see? Did you happen to see the ice caves last year up at Lake Superior?
Those were a huge draw. And our story, Patty Murray's story, in fact, about ice volcanoes was one of the top read stories on the mm-hmm. WPR website last week. So we're here to tell you more. And I think that Carolyn is back with us now. Carolyn, are you there?
Phone calls about ice volcanoes this week, so yet another one coming in, so it's this formation of the waves coming in underneath this ice sheet, pushing up underneath that air pressure, and it creates a cone either on the leading edge of the ice sheet or underneath in the kind of a center section, and the spray just keeps on forming this cone around and makes it higher and higher, and sometimes you can get them up to 30 feet high. Lake Superior actually sees 30-foot cones on the south shore. We don't get them quite that large here on Lake Michigan. Sometimes they appear and disappear within a day.
Do they come around every year? Why is it this the first that most of us are hearing of it this year?
Yeah, they do appear every year. I guess I've never known them to be called ice volcanoes. I just call them ice blows or blow mm-hmm. kind of, 'cause they remind me of a blowhole, and that's really what the physics of them, that's really how it is. It's just a blowhole made out of ice instead of stone, and it's the same formation. But we've had them along Lake Michigan shoreline for the 16 years that I've been working here at the park, and they appear and they disappear, but it's really weather dependent. You need to have the strong onshore waves, so you have a strong wind coming toward the shoreline. You need to have that ice shelf that builds out. You need to have where the air temperature is below freezing, quite a bit. They say at least 10 degrees below freezing, if not more. And you need to have moving water. You need to have that water moving underneath the ice sheet, and that's what causes the spray to come up and create these formations.
And another thing that you've written about and you've taken pictures of, and there's a picture up right now on the Central Time Facebook page, is ice circles. I'd never heard of these before, but they were really kind of cool to see. Tell us about ice circles.
Oh, yeah, those are quite neat. I mean, even back in 1965, Edward Marshall from Ann Arbor, Michigan University actually did some studies on these, what they call pancake ice. And when ice is forming on a kind of a calm day, the ice is moving around in a kind of a light air movement or wind movement or water movement, the ice is forming on top of the lake, and they start making these circular patterns. They keep on bumping up against each other, and they'll be formed rounded. And the longer the ice forms and the more steady of that air current or the wind action, the larger the ice formations. The ice pancakes you can make, or sometimes they call them ice lily pads, is what we've seen. I think there's one picture that I had where it's like a 6-inch, thickness of that ice pancake, and that was really cool to see those. Those lasted quite a number of days to see that in action.
Oh, so they last a couple of days. I was thinking they might sort of merge into one block of ice overnight or something like that.
They can, and that's the uniqueness of and the ever-changing factor of the Great Lakes system. I mean, you can have one day where you come and you're like, oh, the icicles are here, or we've got the ice volcanoes going on, and then you know everyone shows up the next day and they're like, it's dead calm, or it's big waves are crashing, and your icicles are now up on shore and crumpled up and forming icicles, or building what they call ice fleet or ice foot, which is actually just the ice shelf. There's actually terminology for some of these things that we would never have thought of to name, but it's called an ice foot. Is that ice cliff or ice shelf along the shoreline? It's called an ice foot.
Well, this sounds like prime opportunity for photographers who want to go out there and get some unique shots of Wisconsin's winter landscapes. But how would you recommend that we do so in a safe way, especially when you're working with icy conditions? It can be quite slippery out there.
Well, number one thing is, always think of these ice shelves as being over water, as you never know how thick they are. And the depth of the thickness can vary within, a couple of inches to a couple of feet. But it can change overnight, and it can change within the spots you are along the shoreline, because there's wave action, there's water underneath there. And so what we always tell people, look from a distance, always go with a friend, let people know where you are, wear warm clothing, wear ice grips on the bottom of your shoes, take a walking stick with a pole or a ski pole with a point on it to give yourself some depth, and to poke. Those are good for pokers to see what's the depth of, can that ice hold me? And when in doubt, don't go out. It's easier to look at a distance and have someone else take that, or something else take that picture or save that picture from memory internally versus having to be rescued from the water. And as I like to say, hypothermia is not something you want to play with. It is very deadly, and we can lose a lot of people. We want to make sure that folks are safe when they go down the ice shelves. So just be careful.
Carolyn, before we let you go, you've been at Whitefish Dunes State Park for more than a decade. What's the most spectacular thing you've seen along Lake Michigan in the winter?
We had 4-foot waves one December weekend, and the ice went from, there was no ice on the shoreline, to ice bluffs there were bluffs. They were almost a half a story in height. That was really spectacular to see. You can go back every hour, coming to the window, and it was crazy out there. It was windy, it was icy, it was blowing. Horrible weathers to stand out in, too, but as you saw the ice formations just build and build and build and build, and then the next morning everything was dead calm, and it was like, that you have these immense ice structures, and there was blue ice and kind of brown and green, and with the sand mixed in there and the cladophora, it was just really amazing to see it, just spectacular, within a day have it appear. That was cool. That was cool to see. But then within 2 days it was all gone.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us to tell us about these wonderful things to check out along Lake Michigan in the winter.
Well, thank you for having me.
Carolyn Rock is a natural resource educator at Whitefish Dunes State Park. She's the 2014 recipient of the Wisconsin State Historical Society's Preservationist of the Year Award.
And by the way, we've got a slideshow that we're working on of some of Carolyn's photos from the winter of along Lake Michigan that we'll be posting later on the Central Time website.
A retired Central Wisconsin Elementary School principal has found a new calling late in life. Jim Harris has become a bomb removal expert. As Glenn Moberg reports, his mission started out of concern for the families of his Hmong students.
When Jim Harris became principal of Weston Elementary School, there were fewer than a dozen Hmong students there. When he retired in 2003, there were 147.
People thought, oh, it must be a real challenge to have a building with that many low-income families, that many ethnic minorities. The truth was, they were wonderful families.
Harris began taking trips to the country of Laos, first to experience the homeland of his students, and then to help them.
So I could come back at the end of a summer vacation and find students in the hallway and say, I found your grandfather, he's still alive. Or I found your uncle and aunt, and you've got new cousins.
It was during one of those trips that Jim Harris found bombs left over from the Vietnam War.
Cluster munitions, little tennis ball size bomblets that were dropped on Laos. We know we dropped about 280 million individual units. We think there's 70 million left.
280 million cluster bombs dropped on a country of 3 million people.
Every one of the little cluster bomblets has 300 steel ball bearings. And when a load of 670 go off, they cut everything over 3 football fields to ribbons.
Since the war ended, the bombs have caused at least 20,000 casualties, many of them to impoverished villagers salvaging them for scrap metal.
And you know, when you talk to a mother who's just lost a child to an accident, you really struggle to have anything meaningful to say. When that experience has happened, I've pledged the mother that I would do what I could to make sure that another child wouldn't die.
So Jim Harris retired as principal and began a new mission. He trained for a year, learning how to dig up unexploded bombs without killing himself. He formed a nonprofit organization called We Help War Victims. He spends 3 to 6 months in Laos every year.
I hire 12 Lao people. I need a driver. I need a medic. I need a cook. Then I lease our equipment. So I get a couple of trucks and a half dozen metal detectors, tents.
And at the age of 66, he hikes grueling jungle trails with his team. He is not only saving lives, but helping to alleviate poverty. In the fields he clears, villagers are once again growing coffee.
The right volcanic soil, the temperature, the humidity. The problem is, during the war, that area was heavily bombed. And so for 40 years, people have aspired to put a shovel in the ground and plant coffee trees, but they don't dare dig.
Harris raises about half of the money for his missions by selling Laotian coffee. The other half he raises through donations. The money not only removes bombs, it provides surgical care for other still suffering victims of the Vietnam War.
The children who show evidence of birth defects from Agent Orange exposure. We see children with cleft lip, cleft palate, facial tumors, short arms, club foot. We take them to various centers where they can get proper treatment.
Through it all, Jim Harris retains his humility.
If you face a problem that seems too big to change, well, we can't change the world, but we can change one person's world.
An exhibit showcasing Jim Harris's work is on display through the end of the month at the High Ground Veterans Memorial Park in Neillsville. I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News.
You may have noticed that gas prices have steadily been declining over the last few months. Wisconsin is now sitting at an average of nearly $2.50 a gallon, with some stations reporting rates as low as $2.19.
It's good news for consumers, especially around the holiday shopping season, but some are raising concerns over long-term consequences of low oil prices, including volatile market conditions and a potential impact on green energy and alternative fuels. So are low gas prices good or bad, and how long are prices expected to stay low?
Here to help us out is Jim Ritterbush. He's the president of Ritterbush & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, we heard some of the numbers in the intro there. What exactly is behind these falling gas prices?
Well, whenever you get the prices cut in half the way they have been within a six-month period, it usually represents a confluence of developments or events rather than just one particular item. So backing things up to early summer, we saw Libya return exporting oil after a hiatus of about a year or so. Subsequent to that, we started to see some strong indications that global demand for oil was much weaker than expected. In other words, growth in some of the emerging countries that had been carrying the water as far as oil demand growth were starting to slow appreciably, and I'm primarily referring to China. Long story short, most estimates that we saw last spring for global oil demand were about double what they currently are. So demand expectations were cut in half, and prices were cut in half. But it hasn't been simply a demand side story. It's been a supply side story, and that took on further clarity just about a month ago when OPEC had a meeting, and the key members opted to keep their production unchanged rather than adjusting it lower to this downdraft in demand that I referred to.
Let's compare this, say, to 6 months ago when we were around the peak summer driving season. What were prices like then? And is this type of six-month turnaround a typical timeline?
Well, 6 months ago, for instance, crude, which is a primary benchmark here in the United States, it was trading around $102, $105 in that area. And as of today, we saw a new six-month low down to about $55. So historically, this is a pretty low price, especially if you back up to about 2008 when we saw crude prices approaching $150 at one time.
So if we can hone in specifically on some of these variables that you mentioned, like Libya exporting more oil, demand is weaker, especially around the globe, including China. How quickly do we see an impact at the gas pump once these factors come to the fore?
Well, retail prices are slow to respond to the numbers that I monitor in the futures markets. So that's not an unusual lag. It takes time within the chain to filter down to the retail level. So I would say, just in really rough terms, what I'm looking at here today, if I see a price decline of 5 cents in gasoline, which we did see at one time today, that should show up at the retail level within a couple of weeks.
Do these I guess with the falling prices, there might be a growing demand now for gas. When will we start to see those prices going back up?
That's an extremely difficult call. It depends on what scenario that you lay out, and the one that I'm adhering to and presenting to my clientele is one in which OPEC will probably cry uncle early next year. They're pushing prices down in an attempt to reduce this growth in U.S. shale oil production. And I've told people before that I think OPEC will be forced to call an emergency session and cut production, because our output response in the States is going to be slower than what most people anticipate. And I think OPEC is underestimating the creativity and ingenuity of the American oil-producing entities that set this fracking or shale production into motion six, 8 years ago.
What are some of the potential consequences of long-term oil price decreases that we're talking about in just our minute here before break?
Yeah. Long-term is really difficult to say, because when I look at long-term in my business, sometimes I'm looking at a couple of months. But in rough terms, looking out a year from now, we'll probably be higher than where we are now. As far as the consequences are concerned, for at least a year anyway, it's a net plus to the economy. It's not a 50-50 deal. The advantages that flow to the consumer via the extra money that they can spend on other goods, that far outweighs the disadvantages over the short term. Over the long term, it's a different story. Unfortunately, it could tend to quell efforts toward alternative fuels, renewable fuels, things like that, and we don't want that to happen.
We're talking with oil analyst Jim Ritterbush about the continued slide in oil and gas prices, and we want to hear from you, too.
Are you taking advantage of the low prices, enjoying the extra cash in your pocket, maybe traveling a bit more by car, or do you have some concerns about what this could mean long term? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking to Jim Ritterbush. He's the president of Ritterbush & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm. He's with us to talk about why oil prices keep going down and what that could mean for the long term. You can join the conversation with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Jim, I was reading reports that job growth since the 2008 crash of the stock markets has largely been in the energy sector. I'm wondering what kinds of jobs we're talking about and whether these lower gas prices are actually going to hurt job creation across the country.
Well, they'll hurt job creation in areas where you have a heavy concentration of production, such as Texas and North Dakota. But also keep in mind there's fringe companies that that support the entire oil industry. As an example, there's Chicago Bridge and Iron Company in the Midwest that supplies infrastructure to these various projects in the way of design and construction. And they had a stock that was trading at $90 last spring, and today it was trading at $37. So as a lot of companies that are affected by this low pricing see their equity prices decline and see their cost rise at the same time, they will be laying off people. And some of the large firms such as BP, Exxon, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, I think you could see layoffs there totaling thousands. Mm-hmm. However, within the grand scheme of things, these numbers will be small within the context of the U.S. economy. So in my opinion, we're going to see further declines in total U.S. unemployment going forward, notwithstanding the job cuts that we might see within the oil industry.
And on the other hand, as gas prices decline, there's less of an incentive to shift efforts toward more green technologies or fuel-efficient vehicles. Do you think that'll be the case, or is this decline just a temporary one that isn't necessarily going to affect trends toward green technology?
I think the ongoing trends toward alternative fuels, green technology, et cetera, I think that it's a solid trend that won't be inhibited by a brief decline in oil prices. In other words, if this downtrend in oil prices lasts less than a year, it shouldn't have a lot of impact. I see a V-shaped chart here where we take the market down to $45, $48 a barrel in crude, and then we see a very sharp recovery sometime next year. So that should not have a lot of impact on some of these long-term green trends.
Okay. Let's take a call from Bob in Madison. Hi, Bob.
That's good that you recognize that.
Bob, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Hey, I've got an RV that holds 50 gallons of gas. And in this, I park it for the winter, so I always let it run real low on gas right before I park it for the winter. Now it's sitting there, and I'm thinking maybe I should fill it up. But how will I know when the lowest price is?
Were you able to hear that, Jim?
Yeah, okay. I heard the question, and it's tough to call a bottom in any particular market, but I do see lower prices ahead. I think Cynthia alluded to some prices somewhere in the state of around $2.19, and I think that could eventually become an average price across Wisconsin. So I can see $2.20 on average. In the Madison area, maybe 215. I do have a lot of difficulty constructing a scenario that would take us sub $2. But 215, 220, that would roughly tie in with my crude oil forecast.
And Paul in Sturgeon Bay is waiting on the line. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. I'm just curious. I've heard this before in reference to oil and gas. As far as like the difference or the time lag between when it's sold per barrel and then when the price actually starts dropping in the gas station. What is it about oil or petroleum in particular that makes it this unique commodity that has these lags in time in when it, considering price and stuff?
Yeah, I've discussed the item with various corner gasoline stations before, and it's a unique business where when prices are going up dramatically, they tend to lose money on balance because they simply can't keep up with the higher price that they're paying for the commodity. And when the cycle turns and prices drop, they tend to be a bit slower to take these lower costs and pass them along to the user, because that offsets their losses in periods of rising prices. So there does tend to be a lag time on both ends. And like I said before, that's roughly a couple of weeks or so relative to the numbers that I watch here on the screen each day. But you can pretty much assume that gas stations anywhere in the country have seen some very, very favorable margins here during the past several months as prices have dropped and as some of them have been a bit too slow to respond to what's going on.
Now, falling oil prices have hurt the currencies in oil-producing nations, including Russia, where it looks like the ruble is in a sort of a free fall. Are global markets hitting the panic button quite yet or not?
Well, it depends on what market. There's such a variance out there, but your big producers are going to be hit the hardest, and Russia is one of the biggest producers, and this is having a major impact on that country, and it's going to be interesting to see the outcome. A recession in Russia is a foregone conclusion. I don't think there's any doubt about it. It's just a matter of how severe that recession is, simply because they rely on oil as much as they do. And even before oil prices began to decrater, they were seeing economic activity inhibited by sanctions. So they've had a lot of reasons to see their currency decline dramatically to record lows against the U.S. dollar. And they're not the only country that's going through this painful process. Venezuela, for instance, is having severe difficulties with these lower prices. And then you can look at some of your other smaller OPEC producers in Northern Africa, such as Nigeria and Angola and places like that, that will also see a lot of pain from this huge price decline.
Now, I have to ask something that is probably on the minds of a lot of holiday travelers right now. As we're seeing gas prices go down at the gas station, why aren't we seeing airfare going down too?
That's a good question. The airlines have indicated that they are possibly going to reduce some of these fees for extra bags and things like that. But I don't see any collusion going on. But I, on the other hand, I don't see anybody stepping forward and saying, you know what, we've got a sharply reduced jet fuel cost here, and we're going to pass that along to the consumer. So my only observation of significance would be the fact that it's always supply and demand. And from what I understand, planes are being loaded up to capacity these mm-hmm. days. And as a result, that's economics 101. When you've got such strong demand for your product, you're going to be very reluctant to reduce the price of it.
Yeah. Well, Jim, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much, and happy holidays.
Same to you. That's Jim Ritterbusch, president of Ritterbusch & Associates, an oil trading advisory firm. He joined us to talk about the falling oil prices and what it could mean down the road.
Too many cooks, too many cooks, too many cooks,
too many cooks,
too many cooks,
too many cooks.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about a new report showing the difficulties of signing up for unemployment benefits in Wisconsin.
First, you've probably heard this theme song before. A few weeks ago, it seemed like everyone on the internet was obsessed with the late-night parody called Too Many Cooks. It's a mashup of parodies of different 80s sitcom opening themes.
Then it was the podcast Serial that everyone was talking about. The spinoff of This American Life is a true crime podcast about the 1999 murder of a Baltimore teen. Right now, everybody's listening to that, writing about it, sharing articles about it on Facebook. It seems to be everywhere.
And before that, it was True Detective everyone was talking about. Before that, it was the last season of Breaking Bad, the first season of Girls, and the list goes on and on.
Our culture jumps from obsession to obsession quicker than ever before. Here to talk about what she calls the new age of cultural manias is Willa Paskin, TV critic for Slate. Willa, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, before Too Many Cooks, before Girls, before Serial, yeah, we had other things. We had the Beatles, we had Roots, we had Elvis. What makes today's obsessions different?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One is that they're not actually bigger. You know, more people watched Roots or cared about the Beatles than know what Too Many Cooks is or watch True Detective or even Breaking Bad. But I think they feel more omnipresent in a certain way just because we're all hooked into so many other inputs. You know, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're on email, we're reading the internet. And so these things become omnipresent in a way I'm not quite sure they were before, where it was a little bit more like it was in the newspaper, it was in magazines, it was what you talked about with your friends, which is also the case. But now it's also just everywhere on the internet.
So how do you measure success then? If we can say that the numbers of popularity in terms of the people that are actually obsessed with these things is much smaller than about 50 years ago, what is the measure for success when you're the producer of these talk shows or of these podcasts?
Well, I mean, this question about cultural fragmentation and the size of audiences is obviously an important one, and one that I'm sure keeps people who are content creators up at night in general. You know, the size of audiences for everything is sort of smaller than it was just because there's so much stuff vying for our attention. So I think those people, that those producers and content creators that do make something that it seems like everyone's talking about, are probably all very happy still that they sort of hit this kind of water cooler jackpot. Even if it's not quite as big an audience as, you know, it was, it might have been for their product, you know, 20 or 30 years ago.
I mean, it does seem at times like everyone, I guess everyone in quotes, is watching or listening to something. If you go on your Facebook feed, you see a million people talking about something. And so I guess it seems like, look, here's this random sample of people from all these different walks of my life, and they're all saying the same thing. Ergo, everybody's listening to Serial. Is that true in the way we think about it?
Well, obviously it's not true. You know, I mean, I think the thing that the internet does, and Facebook and Twitter and these sort of social media and Instagram and all these things do, is they make it feel like everybody you know is obsessed with something, and that everyone you know is maybe actually a really random selection of people, because it's not necessarily, you know, your intimate confidants and friends and family. It's, you know, people you went to grade school with or went to college with or knew, ran into once some night, you know, 3 years ago. It feels like a random sampling. But the reality is, of course, that that's a self-selected group of people that you are, you know, that you ran into at some point in your life. So I think the truth is that there are, like, lots of different bubbles of groups of people that are interested in totally different things. And clearly, you know, there's people that have never heard of Serial. It's only been on for 10 weeks, you know, or, no, you know, however many people watch Breaking Bad, it still wasn't more than 10 million at a time. So these things feel like they're everywhere, and it feels sort of objectively like they're everywhere. But of course, it's very easy to encounter people who, you know, don't care at all about it and aren't on Facebook and aren't on Twitter and aren't reading the same media that you're reading.
I have to ask a question kind of put through the unique lens of cynicism that only I can bring with regards to Serial, because I know people who are obsessed with it, who have been clamoring for every episode each week, and I've listened to almost every episode myself, but I did not get as hooked to it as other people seem to be. There's a part of me that says, this is a real case. It's still active. He was just granted an appeal. So there's going to be something more happening in real life in the newspapers with regards to it. So why are people so obsessed with the podcast? Can you shed some light on why it is such an addicting product for so many people?
Well, I think a lot of people sort of didn't listen to podcasts. You know, it's the most popular podcast of all time by a pretty significant margin. I think there was something like 5 million downloads a couple weeks ago. It's like 1 million people a week, which, again, is not a huge number compared to other medias, but is a big number for podcasts. And I think it's just very well crafted. And even though it is a true crime story, and it seems pretty clear there's not going to be some like gotcha revelation at the end of this, but we're not going to find out about who actually committed the murder, I think there is something about stories that have this kind of mystery element that allow all of us listening to sort of play the detective or to sort of measure what we think is happening versus the host, that is just really powerful as a narrative device.
Well, speaking about mysteries, it does seem a mystery at times why one thing catches on and another thing doesn't catch on. One thing that you write about is the show True Detective. We've got a clip of that.
To realize that all your life, not all your love, all your hate, all your memory, all your pain, it was all the same thing. It was all the same dream, a dream that you had inside a locked room. That dream about being a person.
So an eerie clip there of an eerie Matthew McConaughey. This is obviously, you know, a very unsettling show. It doesn't sound like something necessarily that tons of people would flock to. So why did that one become a cultural obsession?
Well, again, it also was a mystery, and because it was a fictional mystery, there was a resolution. So I think there really was a lot of people that were interested in kind of finding out what was going to happen and who was going to have been the Yellow King, which was sort of the ultimate bad guy in that show. But, I mean, of course, you know, it does, that Matthew McConaughey clip as Rust Cole, he sounds very metaphysical. It sounds really sort of like esoteric but smart. But the truth is, it was an HBO show. It is an HBO show that starred two movie stars, Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. It looked really beautiful. It was, again, it was sort of had all these genre pleasures, which is like, it's a very straightforward detective story. So I think that the fact that it had this kind of higher brow patina to it, that it seemed like it was so smart, only really helped it in its popularity, because sort of, you know, at baseline, it's a very familiar and popular format, which is a detective story starring famous guys on a network that we've all come to expect gives us good stuff.
So when you analyze the different hits in the various formats, Too Many Cooks, True Detective, Serial, is it apparent why these things are winners, or is there an element of just randomness to it?
I think there's definitely an element of randomness to it. I mean, I think part of, I mean, I would like to think, anyway, that the key thing is that they're good, you know? Something has to actually be good for it to sort of spark this kind of frenzy. But, of course, there's things that are good that don't spark this kind of frenzy, you know? So I think there is, once it's at this threshold of excellence or competence, that then there's a huge element of luck to kind of what captures people's fancy in this kind of mass way.
Is it any sort of coincidence or not that some of these things can only be found through certain proprietary media distribution products, such as like iTunes, and it's not something that's being broadcast into our homes on primetime network television like CBS or NBC, but we have to watch HBO, we have to subscribe to the premium cable channels and so forth to reach them?
You know, I don't quite know the answer to that question. I think it's true. I think part of the appeal of these particular products is that they feel a little bit like their niche, even if they're not exactly, which is just to say, it feels like you found them, and it's special that you like them and that the people that you respect also like them. And you know, things that are on network cable, on network television, don't always have that appeal because they really are available to everyone. There's, you know, it's like there's a little bit of snobbiness sort of inherent in discovering something that there just can't be in it being on, you know, Tuesday nights at 8 where it's there for everyone to discover. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure that it's totally impossible that if the networks put on something really great that it couldn't spark this kind of attention. You know, like Twin Peaks is an example of a show that was, you know, it's on ABC and people were wild about it in exactly this way. It was this mystery and people felt rapaciously interested in it. And that was obviously in the early 90s and a different moment for television. But, you know, that did happen. So I don't think it's impossible, but I do think that there is some element of the fact that they seem a little special and a little shiny is, I think, not irrelevant to their popularity.
Do you think we're missing out on anything as a culture that we don't have these huge cultural milestones that really, you know, mass numbers of people are watching? You know, to take one of your examples, Dallas, the TV show Dallas was watched by millions and millions of people. So when you said who shot JR, everybody knew what you were talking about. Now it might just be, you know, a handful that seems like more than it is. So do you think as a culture there's something lost when it's not quite as many people all enjoying something at once?
Well, I mean, certainly that, you know, lots of people say that. And I think one of the things about the appeal of these sort of micro phenomenon, these like sort of things that feel like everyone's obsessed with them, even if it's not really everyone, is it's so rare, really, relatively speaking, to have something that everyone is excited about. You know, we're so much more used to having at this point sort of more narrow taste just because everyone's watching and consuming and listening to different stuff, that when something sort of seems like it's everywhere, that feels kind of exciting. You know, I mean, that's like something like Beyonce, you know, who is a pop star of a size that is sort of, or Taylor Swift, you know, they're famous in this way that people just sort of aren't anymore. There's something kind of exciting about everyone knowing about them. And I think that that's because it's sort of rarer than it was, people are less cynical and less jaded about, you know, the communal experience and the rare moments that it comes along.
And then how do these things sort of fizzle out?
Well, they just end, you know? I mean, the thing is, we're sort of like junkies for this phenomenon. It's like you find the thing you're obsessed with, you're binge, you know, because the truth is, even if it doesn't rise to the level of like everybody talking about something, we kind of all operate this way at this point. Not all of us, but a lot of people, you know, like you're binge watching a show or you become obsessed with some record and you play it out, you know, like, and then you just kind of, you consume it, you hoover it, you eat it all so fast, and then you just have to go find the next thing.
Well, Willa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking with Willa Paskin, TV critic for Slate. She was with us to talk about the new age of cultural manias. And you can fill us in on your current cultural mania, your current obsession, and why you like it over on the Central Time Facebook page.